Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. 2024 was a year of new weight loss medications. They exploded in use. And in the day-to-day use of these miracle drugs, it's not that tough to manage once you get a handle on it. But in the holidays, and also with these family get-togethers, with these magnificent feasts that will be laid out, it's going to be too easy to overeat, and that could be a bad experience for patients on these medications. And the same for folks trying to manage their type 2 diabetes. But we have some tips. We're joined by Dulce Garcia, a certified diabetes educator and registered dietitian at Baylor College of Medicine. And Dulce, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thank you, David.
So, if a person is taking like Ozempic or some of these other drugs that are using this new GLP-1 medications or semaglutide, or I'm not really sure how we describe it, if they do go into a family event and there's all this food laid out, the turkey and the pumpkin pie and the cranberries and the yams and more and more and more, and then they forget that they're supposed to be cutting back on the on the food, what's the worst that could happen?
Well, you know, there's a lot of misconception with those GLP-1 medications. And really, there's a lack of knowledge as far as understanding how they truly work. When you're using these type of medications, basically what they're doing is slowing down the way your body is digesting those foods. In hopes of that, you are feeling fuller for longer periods of time. So, you know, if you're messing with your GI tract, you definitely don't want to overeat. Overindulging on those foods can usually make you feel a little bit more nauseous.
Right. So let me just reinforce what you're saying. So what this medication does is it slows down your digestion. Is that it?
Yep. So you feel full for longer periods of time.
Right. So if you eat seconds, thirds, you know how we do on the holidays, you're probably going to have, you're going to feel sick, right?
Yeah, you're going to feel sick because, I mean, hopefully if the medication is working well and properly, you should feel full, and you don't want to eat or overeat if your body's already kind of letting you know, I'm done, I'm full.
Right. You will feel sick, or will something bad happen to you?
Not necessarily something bad will happen. I mean, the medication is just to suppress your appetite and hopefully, you know, help you control your intake. So nothing bad will necessarily happen. You'll just feel sick. And the medication, you won't get the benefits of the full medication if you're not controlling your intake necessarily.
Okay. Well, people want to avoid that situation. And our phone number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you get a question about managing your food intake, trying to avoid overindulgence during the holidays, what could it mean for you if you're on these weight loss drugs? Also, if you're trying to manage your type 2 diabetes, you get a question or comment, we've got Dulce here to answer for you. So it does seem to me, though, you do want to be aware of this before you get to the family feast or wherever you're heading, and have a strategy in mind in order to make sure that you don't have that bad experience and feel sick after eating. Is that right?
Correct.
And so what would be a good strategy?
So, you know, everyone does Thanksgiving a little differently, or, you know, the Christmas holiday or any other holidays around those times. Some people kind of have this family meal early in the day. Other people have it later in the day. I would say don't skip any meals prior to that dinner or lunch that you're going to have. When you skip a meal, you tend to arrive to the next meal feeling more hungry. And when you're starving before the meal, you're more likely to overindulge at that time. So don't skip any meals. I would also say make sure that your plate contains a lean protein and some type of non-starchy vegetable. So, like, you know, during Thanksgiving, you have the turkey, and maybe the vegetables are not the favorite sides, but they definitely have some on the menu. You know, you have your green bean casserole, your carrots, and things like that. So I would say start off with those, with the protein and the non-starchy vegetable, because those are the ones that are going to help you feel more full in the moment. And they're also the ones that don't really raise your blood sugar, since we're talking about, you know, people with diabetes. Once you come down to those carbohydrates on your plate, then they have the protein and the vegetables that are kind of help slowing them down as they're being digested. So it also helps you keep your blood sugars more stable around that time. I would say eat slower. You know, it takes your stomach a good 30 minutes to communicate with the brain that it's full. So if you're kind of, you know, chomping away, you're more than likely to overeat around that time. Take small bites, increase your water intake, you know, take sips of water in between your meals, make sure that you're drinking plenty of water before the meal as well. Because with those GLP-1s, as not only are they suppressing your appetite, but people tend to drink less fluids as well. So if you're not drinking plenty of water, if we're overeating, then that itself can also make you feel more sick and nauseous with that medication.
Well, what about alcohol intake?
Well, with the alcohol, it can also make you feel a little sick with that GLP-1. Alcohol, people usually have it with a mixed drink, a mixed sweetened beverage. So if you do have it, something to take in mind is if you are using insulin, you are at risk for low blood sugars. And so I would advise that if you are going to consume alcohol, try to mix it with a non-sweet beverage, making sure that you're checking your blood sugar prior to that consumption, and also trying to combine it with a meal, including those, you know, lean proteins, those non-starchy vegetables, and a small amount of carbohydrates around that time.
When you say a sweet beverage, you mean like soda pop or Texas sweet tea, stuff like that? Avoid that?
Yes. A lot of people, you know, do the alcohol in a mixed drink with juices, with sodas. And so those things that you're mixing the alcohol with will definitely peak the blood sugar, but later on, that same alcohol can cause a low blood sugars.
All right. Well, we're taking a break here, and we're going to continue discussing how to develop some strategies to when you go into those holiday meals in order to avoid a problem, feeling sick afterwards, because there's so much great food, but maybe you're on these weight loss medications or you're trying to manage your type 2 diabetes. It helps to have a strategy. We're talking about that right now, but maybe how do you communicate this to other folks, I mean, in your family? Everyone's kind of like, hey, why aren't you eating? Your mom might be saying, I made your favorite. Why aren't you eating it? Well, what do you tell them? How, you know, is that a problem as well? We're going to talk about that when we come back. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. According to a recently released survey by the Episcopal Health Foundation, they did a survey of Texans. They found that 1 in 10 Texans report that they currently have type 2 diabetes. And another 15% said that they live with type 2 pre-diabetes. And this is becoming a crisis in the state of Texas. We live in a time of great abundance, so much great food, delicious, and yet it's killing us. We got to figure out ways in order to enjoy the good things without over-enjoying and hurting our health. And meanwhile, some folks are on weight loss medication, and that also could impact how they enjoy the holidays as well. So the best way to combat that is with good information, and we're joined by Dulce Garcia, certified diabetes educator and registered dietitian at Baylor College of Medicine. So Dulce, should I go into the family events on Thanksgiving Day and I say I really can't eat too much because I'm on Ozempic or something?
Well, you know, I'm not the food police. Food should be enjoyable around the holidays, but we definitely want to be mindful of what's on the plate for sure.
Right. So, I mean, is there a stigma? I mean, I don't think people would be too judgy if they say, hey, that's cool. That's great. Hey, I've got questions for you. I want to know how did you get it? Because I can't find it. I mean, people really want to talk about it. And if you tell them that you're on this weight loss medication because you're dealing with health concerns, it's not just because you want to look fab, you know, but, you know, I think people should be open and explain why they're not going to be piling on the plate.
Absolutely. I mean, even if you share with family and friends about your diagnosis, you have a more of a support system around that time. So, you know, if people know that you're dealing with that, they're a little bit more considerate. They're definitely not pushy on, you know, going for seconds. Whoever is hosting may even, you know, provide more menu options that are more diabetes friendly. So I think it is a good idea to kind of share with whoever you're hanging out with about your diagnosis. That way you have additional people to kind of help support you around that time and that meal.
I think maybe depending on your family, some families are a little more difficult than others. But if you tell, you know, whoever is preparing everything this Thanksgiving, if you ask them if they could consider making some diabetes-friendly options for the spread, that might be a good idea. What are your thoughts?
That is a good idea. And also, like, you know, if it's the type of event where it's like a potluck, kind of bringing their own dish, you know, if you're the person who does have the diabetes, you could try to make or bring something that's a little bit more diabetes friendly for yourself. And not to forget to mention that, you know, if you're diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, you know, that's very genetic, right? Does other people in the family also have diabetes? And so you're not only helping yourself, but you're potentially helping another family member or friend at the table as well.
So what are some suggestions for some diabetes friendly options for holiday meals?
So I would definitely try to incorporate some type of vegetable and particularly a non-starchy vegetable, because those are the ones that tend to be lower in carbohydrates.
And a non-candied vegetable, probably.
Preferably. But, you know, David, even though, let's say you do add, you know, some glazed pecans, or you combine it with something that's a little bit more sweet, you're still reducing the amount of carbs you're consuming. And so that's what I'm saying. If you do add some type of non-starchy vegetable, it's still a benefit in your end, because you're increasing your fiber and you're consuming something in that meal that doesn't contain as much carbohydrates.
Right. And so when people say, you know, hey, you're just showing off. This is just one meal, one day out of the year. I mean, come on, you can have these candied yams. It's not going to kill you. It could get icy trying to explain what you're trying to do to some family members.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, you just kind of have to have a little bit more, I'm not sure if self-control is the word here, but don't get bullied into eating something that you don't want to. If, you know, you're showing up to this event and you come in with a plan that, hey, this is what I'm planning to have, like, don't feel bad saying no.
Right.
It's your choice to kind of serve what you put on your plate. You shouldn't feel obligated to, you know, go for a side or something that you're not feeling comfortable with. And again, going back to explaining or just mentioning, no, this is not what I'm shooting for at this time. You know, hopefully you're around people that accept that as well and support you.
Well, you know how families are. You know, it's a mixed bag. And so how do you stay on top of the sugar levels during the holiday meals and parties?
I would encourage, well, you know, a lot of people use like those continuous glucose monitors. Some people
like the little like plastic thing that's in your arm type of thing.
Yeah. So a lot of people have those nowadays, and you can easily see what your blood sugar is doing, like on a mobile app, or with the receiver that it comes with. Some people are still doing the old school finger sticks where they poke their finger. So I would say check your sugar before you start the meal, because that kind of gives you a good idea of where you're at and how much you may be able to have. If you're starting off with the meal, if you're starting off the meal with a high blood sugar, then hey, maybe let's not serve as many of those foods that are going to make the sugar go up. But if you're starting off with a good ideal blood sugar, then it gives you a little bit more freedom to serve a little bit more on that plate that you're wanting. And it's very normal for the sugar to go up when we're eating, even if you don't have diabetes. Sugar always goes up. But what we don't want is for those sugars to go up and stay up for a long time. And so 2 hours after, you kind of want to see where you're at. And that gives you a better idea if, you know, if you overdid it, and if you did, okay, fine. It's one meal. Try to be active after the meal. Drink more water, because that also helps bring the sugars back down into range.
Well, I've learned that diabetes is an unforgiving drug, unforgiving disease condition. And when you do have, you know, you bring your sugars up for a long period of time, that's it's doing irreversible damage at times to your body. It's a very serious situation.
Yeah, I mean, but really, when you're a diabetic, you have to have a toolkit, right? Because we're not striving for perfection, but really what you're wanting is, if my sugar is high, knowing what to do when the sugars are high. If my sugar is low, what do I need to do there? So for a lot of people with diabetes, high blood sugars is more of the case. And so when your sugars are high, just know, hey, I can drink more water, because that'll increase urination. I get to kind of help flush some of that sugar out in the urine. I can become more active. Let me go burn some of that energy. You know, like I just got done doing my Thanksgiving, Christmas dinner. Let me help clean up. Let me move around. Maybe there's a family game or some dancing that we can do. Obviously, if the sugar is high, let me not eat something that's going to make it worse in the moment.
Yeah, show off your Zumba moves.
Yeah, that's the perfect time to kind of do things like that, because that alone really helps keep the blood sugars more in range around that time.
Well, what happens if you decide, I'm not going to take my GLP-1 drug during the holidays because I want to avoid these problems? I want to really, you know, live it up during the holidays. Would that be a problem?
I would not encourage that, because one, if your body's used to kind of taking that GLP-1 and you stop it 1 week or the next, then it creates kind of some confusion. And then that weight loss that you're anticipating is not going to happen. Usually when people take these GLP-1s, they take it once a week. And let's say, you know, you take it on a Thursday. On Wednesday, the day before you're supposed to kind of redo it, your appetite's coming back. And so when your body's used to having that GLP-1 in the system and then it's out of it, your appetite comes back very strong. And so it's even harder to control your appetite if it's out of your system. And, you know, around the holidays, people tend to kind of gather and kind of share some time over food. These are the time of the year where people tend to eat more. And so having that GLP-1 in your system is something that's going to help you stay on track a little better. So I would not encourage to stop it. I would keep it. This is the best time of the year to kind of have that medication in your system if that's what your body needs.
Right, and a lot of people are taking this because of a health issue, diabetes or high blood pressure or other issues, and so that's why you're on it, really.
Exactly.
So I'm really interested in what you said about not skipping meals before and like not skipping breakfast because you know there's going to be a big lunch or something. And there's so much talk all the time about intermittent fasting and how great fasting is. And you're saying that is not a good idea to skip these meals going into the afternoon or dinner event. And why is that again? And why not fast?
So with that GLP-1, what happens is if you go too many hours without eating, you're more than likely to feel nauseous. That's just a side effect that comes with those type of medications. Now, if you weren't taking those medications, another thing here is, hey, if you're just going really long periods of time without eating, you're going to be very hungry at a certain point of the day. And really, you shouldn't want to arrive to a meal feeling hungry already, because you're less likely to make good decisions and selections during those times. And you're more than likely to overeat if you're already arriving to the meal feeling hungry.
And overall, do you think that the intermittent fasting is a good strategy, should be deployed? They say it's good for trying to bring down inflammation. Inflammation is connected to many chronic diseases. So trying to lower inflammation through your eating habits, is that doable?
I mean, there's a lot of pros and cons to intermittent fasting, and then there's different types of intermittent fasting. So I would say, hey, for someone who does have diabetes, you don't want to spend the whole day eating, and you definitely want to take little breaks in between. That way you give your body some time to kind of digest that food and kind of stabilize sugar again.
Now, if you go to the family meal and you talk about, I'm not going to overindulge because I'm dealing with my type 2 diabetes, and you say there are probably other people at the table who are also either pre-diabetic or have type 2 diabetes. I mean, is that an opportunity to really talk about this issue that probably is pretty chronic and evident and needs to be addressed?
I mean, like I said earlier, if you have type 2 diabetes, it's more than likely you have another family member there who's kind of struggling with the same thing. Or someone else at the table is going to know someone else that is dealing with type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes. And so having a conversation about it just kind of allows other people to gain a little bit more information to either kind of help themselves or another loved one.
And it's good to have someone to model this behavior for the rest of the group to show that it can be dealt with. That you don't. There's a fatalism sometimes that comes with the diagnosis.
Yeah, not only that, but I mean, if you have kids and you know you're dealing with type 2 diabetes, you're kind of instilling healthy habits.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Dulce Garcia, for a certified diabetes educator and registered dietitian at Baylor College of Medicine. I hope you have some happy, healthy holiday meals.
Likewise. Thank you, David.
And when we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about a question that's been plaguing San Antonio for generations. If the city is doing so well economically, then why is there still so much poverty? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about a new mega running event for San Antonio. The city's ditching the Rock and Roll Marathon, what they're going to use to take its place. But right now, let's talk about the wealth gap in San Antonio. It can be easy to ignore if you never leave your side of town. But when you take a bird's eye view of SA, or you can see that they're actually two different cities kind of smashed together. One side is prosperous and the other side is mired in poverty. Texas Monthly's distinguished writer Mimi Schwartz went looking for answers. Her article is San Antonio was booming. Why is it still so poor? And Mimi Schwartz, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
So this is one of those difficult questions. This is something that can cause some of those stressful conversations in San Antonio when you say, well, you know, one side of town has a lot and it looks great, and it's and the other side, not so good. It has a lot of poverty. And why is that? And why has it been like this for so many generations? And what did you find?
Well, I found a lot of reasons. I mean, one thing I would say is it's not one side and another side. It's one side and then it's one quarter and then three quarters almost that are living at least paycheck to paycheck and can't make ends meet if they're not living in dire poverty. But I think there are many, many reasons, but one remains this dependence on tourism and convention business, which tend to be low-wage jobs. So you've got a lot of people who are working. I mean, that's one of the differences between San Antonio and other cities. We've got an incredible employment rate. Unemployment is at 4%, which is great, but no one, but most of the people working in those jobs aren't making enough to really support their families.
So how does San Antonio compare to other cities in terms of this problem? I mean, it does seem like San Antonio has this segregation along, you know, classic lines, racial lines, but then all, and we had a lot of redlining in neighborhoods, but those, that went away a long time ago. So why are we still dealing with that?
It's a really good question, and it's one I was trying to answer. And again, I think it comes back to what kind of industry the city was able to attract and what kind it hasn't been able to attract. And one of the issues, like a place like Pittsburgh, which has been able to recover sort of from being a Rust Belt city, is Tier 1 university, which San Antonio doesn't quite have yet, because the kind of corporations that would help the economy in San Antonio want that kind of thing. And so it's sort of, you know, it's a Gordian knot almost, trying to untie the myriad problems that keep it poor. But again, I think it goes back to an economy that's based on tourism and conventions mostly.
Well, if there were some sort of turnkey solutions that might be able to help a city like San Antonio trying to pull itself up, but the city is also dealing with competition from Austin, Dallas, Fort Worth, right. Houston. I mean, do those those types of opportunities, would they tend to go to these other cities?
They still do. Yes, especially Austin, because the university became a big draw for all of those tech jobs that I think Henry Cisneros tried to get to San Antonio, and it just didn't work out. He was a little late trying to attract them. So Austin, which already had a huge sprawling university, won that fight. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things to try is sort of to expand that corridor, which I think Cisneros would very much, I think he sees that as a possible solution.
So a better link between San Antonio and Austin,
right,
like a rail link or some other high-speed way to connect it to, not I-35, which is a parking lot most times, not reliable.
My editor works, the editor-in-chief of Texas Monthly, of course, works in Austin, but his house is in San Antonio, and it drives him crazy that not even the Vaughn Lane bus will, you know, come, has a route between San Antonio and Austin because there aren't enough people. And I think it's the same problem with the airport. I think, you know, we'll see what that expansion does. But again, there isn't enough business travel out of San Antonio sort of to support the kind of airport we have here, the kind of air travel that the airlines want.
And also, you look at, this has been a problem for San Antonio for a long time, even going back to when we had the 1968 World's Fair here.
Yeah.
And there was a CBS documentary on hunger that looked at San Antonio at that time in the shadow of the World's Fair, far away from it, even at the Robert B. Greene Hospital and the neighborhoods, the barrios nearby, still a grinding poverty. And you can, not that much has changed actually since then.
Well, that's, it's unfortunately true. I mean, there is, you know, I hate to blame racism for everything, but I think that it's taken a very long time for the Latino population to, you know, to be able to get out of the poverty that the first inhabitants, you know, or many of the first immigrants were in. There were, you know, when we were part of Mexico, it was a different story. But I think, again, you've got 17 school districts, 17 or 18 in San Antonio, and that's a problem because you've got north side schools that are terrific and you've got west side schools that are sort of hanging on. And that is a historic fact. I mean, it's been that way for so long, and it's the same thing with housing. There's a Trinity professor named Christine Drennan who's done a spectacular job of tracking how the availability of housing really almost from the beginning of San Antonio's founding has been segregated.
And so we started off the conversation and I said two cities smashed together and you said it's not really half and half. It's more like a quarter and then three quarters. So so like with the northwest part of the cities, what part is the part you think is the most?
I think the north side. When people talk about the north side, I think that's where the wealth is still concentrated. And you're right. Mostly it's grown to the northwest because of, you know, things like Fiesta, Texas, where you've got some kind of tourist attraction, but then around it, some very nice, very expensive housing developments. So, you know, I would say north and then again, northwest and then again toward Austin, where you basically, you know, you do have kind of a megalopolis growing there. But I think one thing we did was do some maps in the current issue. And when you look at the redlining maps from the 30s and the racial concentrations from the 30s, they're still very much the same today, where wealth is concentrated sort of in a sliver of the north side. And I was listening to your guests before, and the diabetes rates track with the poverty rates, mostly on the west, south, and east sides.
Well, you look at almost any kind of measure of success or failure, and it's going to track along those, like, you know, dropout rates, teen pregnancy rates.
High school graduation rates, yeah.
All those things that still fall along those same lines. And so the question is, like, what can be done? I mean, if I guess you could say the city is fortunate to have any prosperity at all. How do you tap into that to improve drag the rest of the city up?
Well, that was what was nice. I talked to a lot of people who had solutions. And one, you know, I think Houston had to diversify after the oil bust, and I think San Antonio is trying. I think the improvements at UTSA are good. I think the developments downtown, which are still pretty much for the wealthy, I'm talking about the new ballpark and the areas around it, those will create jobs, but I think San Antonio could provide a lot more affordable housing. I think raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour would make a big difference. And the amount the city spends on healthcare, it's 2.5% of the city's $3.9 billion budget. And the property tax rate, which is 54 cents on every $100 of taxable value, has not changed for 30 years. So, and then again, a lot of these big companies and the big developers get tax breaks when maybe it would be better if they didn't.
Or hold them to a higher standard.
I mean, what Drennan said really has stayed in my mind, which is, you know, the poor here have subsidized the wealthy for decades. We can begin to imagine redistribution in the other direction.
Has leadership been the problem? We're running out of time here, but what do you think?
I think the leadership could be better. I think Mayor Nirenberg is trying, but unfortunately, it's just not enough.
All right. I want to thank you for this article. Mimi Schwartz, distinguished writer at Texas Monthly. San Antonio is booming. Why is it still so poor? Thanks for talking to us today, Mimi.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks. You too. And when we come back from the break, San Antonio is going to be minting its own premier mega running event. We're going to have the details on that when we come back from the break. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On the weekend of December 7th and 8th, the Rock and Roll Marathon will be taking over some San Antonio streets. After 16 years, this will be the last time for this running event in San Antonio. Now the City of San Antonio and San Antonio Sports have announced they're going to do their own marathon running event. That's going to kick off in 2025. It'll be December 7th. 2025. Mark your calendars. You can be out there. And joining us now to tell us more and answer your questions, Jenny Carnes is the president and CEO of San Antonio Sports. And Jenny, welcome to The Source.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you got a question for Jenny about why we are making the switch to a locally produced marathon event. So, Jenny, what is the big why? Why are we telling the Rock and Roll Marathon to hit the bricks someplace else?
Well, we've been a proud partner with the Rock and Roll Running Series, as you said, for 16 years, and we're coming to the end of that contract. And over the past 16 years, we've seen the running community in San Antonio really grow. We've seen what it's done for San Antonio in the health and fitness space, and it's really changed the landscape for what San Antonio looks like. And so as the city has grown up, San Antonio Sports has grown up as a sports commission, and we just felt like the timing was so good to start something of our own that was branded a destination marathon, very much like a New York, a Boston, a Chicago. But one of the other main reasons why we thought this time was right is because San Antonio was just awarded a convention called TRE, or the running event, which is actually where I'm standing right now. It's in Austin, and it is moving to San Antonio next year and will be the same week as our brand new marathon. So this is the largest retail running convention in North America and brings thousands of people. So we're labeling it kind of the epicenter of running for that week, and they'll be Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then we roll right into the San Antonio Marathon weekend. It's pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, that'll be great. One of the benefits, seem like, of the Rock and Roll Marathon is it has a lot of glitz and glitter and, you know, with it. And so people who typically didn't see themselves as runners started to say, like, I would like to do that. And a lot of local running clubs like the San Antonio Roadrunners would help people get them Rock and Roll Marathon ready. And so I guess that's still going to continue, or maybe we'll have even more energy for that in 2025 with these local groups working with San Antonio Sports.
We're going to have more energy. And if you're familiar with the Rock and Roll brand, obviously the theme on the route is music. But our theme for San Antonio is going to be every step tells a story. So it's our chance to tell the stories about what makes San Antonio and our culture so uniquely beautiful. And then the stories of our participants along the way as they train throughout their journey to get to that event, no matter what distance they're running. So we're going to take that theme and incorporate what San Antonio is, who San Antonio is, And Miles will have the Military City USA theme, the Spurs theme, the Riverwalk theme, a culinary theme, a mariachi theme. I mean, I could go on and on. We know San Antonio very well. And so runners are going to get to experience more than just music on a course. They're going to experience firsthand our culture while they're walking, rolling, or running through it.
So San Antonio's also been developing more running trails, linear parks, and things like that. Will that be incorporated into the San Antonio Marathon?
Well, that's another good reason why we thought this was good timing. And we have over 100 miles of a linear park system, and you see so many more runners out there because there's a space to do it. We have yet to design our course. We're working with some pretty amazing people on a national scale to come in and do that in early part of 2025. And so we'll figure out what that looks like if we can get down onto the river and onto the trail system. But it obviously depends on the size of participation as well. But we're going to showcase the best of San Antonio, landmarks, neighborhoods. We want this to be a marathon and a half marathon and a 5K that San Antonio owns and comes to love and visitors come to love.
And so with the marathon opportunity to explore the city, also for visitors to come and discover San Antonio, do you think that this will also be a way for because one of the great things about, you know, San Antonio is that, you know, we can have a December marathon towards the end of the year with some pretty good weather. Not many places in the country can do that. And so it does seem to attract people to around the country to come to the city for maybe their last marathon of the year.
Yeah, we pretty much will be the last marathon of the year around the country. And to be able to come to a climate like ours where temperatures are still pretty mild, it's great running weather. And you're coming to San Antonio during one of the most beautiful times of year when the Riverwalk is lit up and Houston Street is lit up and you feel that holiday spirit. In fact, we're doing our 5K on Friday night. We're going to do a nighttime 5K that runs through Houston Street and downtown underneath the lights. So it's a beautiful time to be in San Antonio. We expect to have good weather. It's going to be just an outstanding experience for visitors to come here maybe for the first time, or locals to enjoy and be really proud that they're from San Antonio. And this marathon is owned by San Antonio Sports. And profits that hopefully come from this new event will stay in San Antonio to support our youth and community programs that San Antonio Sports puts on for free throughout the city each and every year.
And the Rock and Roll Marathon events did bring in people to stay in our hotels and enjoy San Antonio's hospitality. Do you expect the same result with the locally produced marathon?
We really do. I mean, this is a city that we know people love to come to. We're hosting the NCAA Men's Final Four coming up next spring for the fifth time. And people love coming to San Antonio because it's a destination city. It's in the middle of the country. There's so many great things to do. There's so many great restaurants. There's great places to play. So I think visitors are going to love this new model.
And will this also be a Boston qualifier?
It sure will. And that was very important to us, that we sanction our course and it becomes a Boston qualifier. You know, our goal and our aim is to have a fairly fast and flat course to be able to do so. And that's a big part of, you know, what makes a marathon stand out, is that if it's sanctioned and does become a qualifier.
How many people actually go to and participate in the San Antonio Rock and Roll Marathon? How many go, you know, I mean, it's always like a life goal for a lot of people. I want to run a marathon. About how many people do that?
It's varied throughout the years. In 2008, which was our inaugural year to bring rock and roll to the city, we still hold the all-time participation attendance record for an inaugural marathon at just over 32,000 runners and walkers. It's dipped since then. I think they're anticipating about 19,000 total coming up in a few weeks between all of their distances. So our goal is to start at, you know, in that 18 to 20,000 range next year, and for it to be just as big of a deal.
And how do you encourage people who are not runners to tell them that this is also for them?
Well, I would say, you know, start slow. Get out there and just get some steps in. Get on one of our trails out through San Antonio. Enjoy being outside. Start with a 5K and then, you know, work your way up. I used to be a runner. I've done the Rock and Roll several times, both full and half, but now I just walk it, and that's okay. You don't have to come out and win your race category or your age category. You can walk it and just feel really good about doing something great for yourself and finding the best version of yourself along the way.
A lot of people are very attentive to the swag that you get at a marathon, the medals and the T-shirts and the capes and all other kind of paraphernalia that come with that. I guess, the San Antonio Marathon will have a distinctly San Antonio vibe with its swag.
Oh, absolutely. And it'll be like most other major runs. You'll get the T-shirt. You'll get an incredible medal at the end. You'll be able to enjoy 2 days of an outstanding expo with all of the running retailers involved. But we want everything to feel uniquely San Antonio. So more to come on what that looks like. But we just launched our new logo and our brand this past Monday in open registration. I think everybody will be really proud of what the brand and the logo looks like. It captures who we are in San Antonio.
Well, the Rock and Roll Marathon isn't cheap. But I have noticed that what you're looking at, the prices I've seen for the San Antonio Marathon does seem more reasonable. Was that a strategy?
Absolutely. We want to make sure that this is an event that that everybody can attain to do. And we're starting out at $79 for the half marathon and $89 for the full marathon. And that is significantly cheaper than a lot of the other major events. And yeah, that was very strategic. And so now's the time to register early, because like every other thing out there, prices increase throughout the year. So SanAntonioMarathon.com, I'd say go and get registered today while it's very affordable.
And was it a hard decision? Was this an easy decision to make the switch? Do you think you just figured that people will recognize that let's make this a San Antonio event by San Antonians and celebrating San Antonio? That will be a great selling point.
It wasn't an easy decision. This has been something, a part of our strategic plan with San Antonio Sports for years and years, that we own our own marathon. But when the stars align for us with capturing this TRE running convention and the Rock and Roll contract expiring, yeah, then it was an easy decision. So we're really excited about it.
Jenny Carnes is the president and CEO of San Antonio Sports, telling us about the San Antonio Marathon that will be on December 7th, 2025. And I'll see you at the starting line. Jenny, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.